Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to our final seminar. Thanks again for your communication, the questions and comments you sent. You saw my email that reflects the bullets that I sent are a composite of comments that I've received and summarized there, and we'll cover, as I mentioned, a kind of revised plan for our final seminar. I'll wrap in what I plan to do, but also I want to address those questions and guess which one I added. So is there anything that you'd like to begin with, any questions or comments as we launch our final seminar? I'm going to leave the I just changed my mind. I hear some interference. I'm going to put us on lecture mode so that you won't have to worry about noise or you know, any kind of ambient movement noise and that sort of thing. So any questions or comments or additions that you want to add before we go on presentation mode?
So, hi, everybody. This is Danny Bidoni, David. How are you? I did a variety of summaries. How are you, everybody? I'm so excited. I did a variety of ways to communicate. Are we expressing it? Are we exposing it? Or what would be the plan?
Would you tell me that question again specifically? I want to be sure I understand.
Oh, on the 10 questions, are you asking us to discuss about it, the 10 questions? Is it going to be like an open mic, or do we raise our hands on the things that we want to talk about? How would that be like?
I was originally thinking about an open discussion. Are there comments that you would like to make? I'd like to keep it open if possible, if there's a management or background. Is there input and discussion that you would like to add?
To discuss through, you know, each question and have like an open mic of everybody talking about what we believe, or is it just one candidate per question?
Well, let's do it this way then. Because of the number of people and to minimize any distractions, let me begin with the first couple or three, and then pause, and then come back on to open the mic up for any comments or questions. How about that? And then I'll resume with the lecture mode, because I don't want any distraction for those of you who are listening or for the recording. Does that sound good, Danny?
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks very, very much. Super. Okay. We're gonna go on presentation mode then. Be sure and write down any comments, questions you have. I'm going to follow pretty much the order of the bullets I have, and then I'll move to some of the things that we'll wrap into this discussion in the from the outline. So let's begin with these questions. This is a distillation of some of the common observations, questions that some of you have made and that I hear from this kind of material. So I want to capture what will be most useful to you and perhaps begin with these questions then. So first, some of these sound so simple, but I want to consider them with you in terms of being informed by the mind and brain and performance sciences. How can that help us better answer these questions to optimize what we can do with our clients? So first, how can you help somebody change their mind? Now, the brain opposes new information in order to preserve the default mode. Remember, we talked about if you hear if you decide to give someone information, facts, data, they're going to compare it with what they already know. And if it fits, they're going to find a way to confirm it. If it doesn't, they're going to refute it. So what can we do? If we attempt to introduce change even by more information, by reminding the benefits of seeing or doing things in a particular way, which of course is naturally ours, or even pushing, that will enhance the opposition. So the antithesis of information and suggestion is to ask a question. Asking a question shifts the listener's perspective, the client's perspective, to one of participant, to look for answers together rather than either opposing or accepting. Either of those create closure. Now, the client wants us, not consciously necessarily, but it's not so unconscious, to give advice or directives or opinions or even multiple choice possibilities, because that would foreclose any consideration and discomfort of continuing to explore. We also have a desire at some level to do that because that ends the uncertainty. We are bringing closure and certainty, and that's what our brains seek, to find closure, to not have to tolerate the ongoing energy that it takes to consider something new or different. So how do you ask then the best questions? Open-ended questions. This is bread and butter stuff, but I want to review this from a mind and brain perspective here. Open-ended questions engage a mindset of inquiry and collaboration. So, and this gives rise to the next question: how can communication be most effective? Well, it can be most effective, and this begins with our questions to the client, when it's clear, brief, and simple. The four principles of good writing and good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. Same for us as coaches, to ask a simple question and then pause and wait for the client to respond. Now, we have a limited bandwidth for decisions, and our brains prioritize immediate rewards over delayed rewards. So the greater delay, the less specific and even less evident a consequence is, the less likely it's going to influence behavior. It's kind of like, as we discussed before, you have an immediate reward. You can spend money right now, and the anticipation of spending gives you a hit of dopamine. To look at a delayed response that's abstract in the future, such as saving for retirement, there's no dopamine anywhere on the horizon for that deal, but that can compete with the immediacy of that response. So this is where what we do as coaches can look at balanced decisions. And I'm introducing here the Texas two-step, which we'll come to specifically, as a kind of a micro system. So when we speak more briefly with clarity, consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, Dr. Mark Wallman, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research using the 10-10 principle. What he did was to get, and these are in a series of research protocols of actual situations of groups that were doing contentious situations of divorce, mediation, arbitration. He got both sides, each side, to agree to limit their responses to 10 words. He had each person who would speak hold both fists and extend one digit for each word and agree to stop, and then it was the other side's turn. What he found was that in these charged situations, they resolved faster, averaged 20 to 25% of the usual time, and reached more satisfying and complete conclusions. And this is a simple brain principle also of cognitive strain. Think about when you listen to my paragraphs. When you listen to someone and they're talking in paragraphs or in extended, lengthy, compound sentence, you have to remember what they said at the beginning, pair it with what they mention in the middle, and then keep in mind that when they get to the end of the sentence. So when you have someone who really speaks in paragraphs, unless you really work at it, you're going to plan what you have for dinner that night before they get through. So the best sentences are 10 to 12 words and clear, brief, simple, and specific. So that may be a guideline, not a rule, maybe a principle or a guideline for asking powerful questions for us as coaches. And when you get to the point, those of you who want to or already have, when you do ICF certification, the couple of recordings you sent in, you only want to ask powerful questions. If you don't, you're out of there. Now, the more advanced levels, that's a different story, but this is first level. So how do you then ask, the 20 to 25% of the usual time, and they reached significantly more satisfying and complete conclusions. So they had a closure that was very satisfying. So how do you then ask the best questions? That's such a simple, and yet it's a broad question. One thing to think about, we talked about bright spots earlier. We focus and grow in the direction of what we're asked about. Dr. Diana Whitney is the founder of Appreciative Inquiry. She described systematic studies of appreciative inquiry in organizations and found three things. She was a guest of mine on an expert contributor in a mastermind group and explained this very carefully. Three simple things. A focus on what works enhances what works. It's a positive framework. We'll come back to that. Focus becomes a reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive mindset. A focus on problems boots up a problem mindset. And a focus on what works, the third, a focus on what works awakens possibility, an aha experience that boots up a mindset that is more creative and synthetic and integrative. As we talked before, you look at an fMRI of a brain with an aha moment, three different parts light up. Give information, data, facts, nothing. No light up. Nothing responds at a brain level. So appreciative inquiry looks at how a person or an organization can look for the possibility, the best there is, and use that information to build on what's already working. People have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of the past forward. This is a whole area that we are just now beginning to incorporate in professional coaching, but it's huge. So this approach can get way better results than seeking out or solving problems or giving right answers. It's a complex science designed to not ignore problems, but simply to approach them from a different perspective, a different framework. And appreciative inquiry shows that collaborative strengths do more than simply enhance performance. They transform. Another question. Why not focus on problems in order to resolve and move beyond them? That's the usual framework and mindset of consultants. That's the usual framework of therapy and counseling. Some studies by Dr. David Copperwriter in a number of organizations did match as much as possible situations of looking at problems, going in and asking the usual consultant question to the group of organization. What's the problem? How can we solve it? The usual consultancy. The other, as much as possible, matched organization he entered asking about what are the possibilities and what are the opportunities. The act of asking positive questions resulted in a significantly better result and more satisfaction and engagement, because the positive image creates a dynamic force in the individual as well as in the team culture. So, evidence from brain science research shows how a positive focus is immensely more powerful in aligning intention and the brain energy field to bring about what we want. The confident, positive focus is contagious with others, and a leader's positive emotions are more contagious than anyone else's. Now, I'm not talking about just positive thoughts. You know, positive thoughts are, you know, like turning on a computer and thinking positively. It needs engagement. This is a co-creative endeavor where we're looking at a mindset of engaging and collaboration in doing this. So consider this. Does how you began, let me pause and put us on discussion mode. I forgot I was going to ask you guys your input and feedback and thoughts. Hold on. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. Thoughts or questions or clarifications or additional things that you'd like to talk about or have us talk about or to add? Anyone? I cannot have been that clear. Go ahead. Was there a comment?
Yeah, this is Danny Bedone. I wanted to talk about this positive mindset with the word autonomy. One of the things I've realized, apart from being positive with my clients, is that the more choices they feel they have, the more decision and the more they reconsider it. So I always ask them, it's something to think about. What do you think about that? You know, this kind of autonomy of that they can be facilitating their own change mindset.
Absolutely. That establishes a framework. Think about how a very practical example of that. Darren Brown did an experiment in the UK, in London, I think on Regent Street, which has a lot of pedestrian traffic. Darren placed his wallet with money clearly sticking out on the sidewalk. He then drew a circle with yellow chalk around the wallet, kind of like crime scenes on TV. Then he walked away, leaving the wallet lying there. And he filmed it, unbeknownst to the people. Hundreds of people walked past the wallet. Most saw it. Many stopped to look at it, but no one picked it up. The yellow chalk circle seemed to be a barrier that people were reluctant to cross. That framed that situation as don't touch. So the framework determined everything that followed. So the yellow chalk circle, also in another way of thinking about it, created a barrier. It's an assumption that limit people from simply picking up the wallet. So consider, what's your yellow chalk circle, if you have one? Are there assumptions or frameworks that might work better? You know, we talked earlier, and that's a great point. I appreciate you highlighting that. We talked earlier about a positive framework frames the remainder of a conversation or consideration, because it boots up a particular mindset. A problem mindset then boots up a very different mindset to consider things and focuses what follows. So how we begin something with a client, our initial question can frame a conversation. Can I get a management of the background noise to mute unless you're about to say something? So other thoughts or follow-up to that or any other questions? Anything else to add? Now here's a actually let me go back on lecture mode and come back for any questions and I'll promise to come back sooner next time. Okay, yeah, we're in lecture mode now. And this relates to the question, how can mental framing determine outcome? Which is exactly the question, just in slight variation. So what do you think of when I say, don't think of an elephant? Now, that statement is the title of a book by a social psychologist whose work I followed, Dr. George Lakoff. That's the title of his book. That ensures that you're going to think about an elephant. That's his point. Whether the focus is negative or positive, it activates the imagery of the elephant. You cannot not think about an elephant. Neuroscience and quantum physics show us that we get what we focus on, not what we want. That focus can be determined in a number of ways to enhance performance. Because a focus aligns the energy field of the brain. Words even activate a particular brain mindset. Our brains are structured in a cascade network that links brain circuits that are associated with a particular word or concept or emotion. Then a specific language triggers these cascades to boot up a mindset that then processes the remainder of the information. So frames are simply the mental structures in our brains, the mindsets that shape the way we perceive and process information. Our mindset, our state of mind determines what we take in as information and then how we process it and how we behave. The ABCs, affect, the feeling, the behavior, the cognition, the thinking about it, and the sensation, all are part of that mindset. And this is where the Texas three-step will be useful in just a moment. So this automatic, unconscious, instantaneous choice we make in these responses, these are ones that we can get our client to pause and reflect on, to develop an awareness so that they can create a choice that will be in their best interest. So this can become what has become automatic, can become a process, a system that we can introduce in coaching. So here's a simple, probably way too simple, application, the Texas three-step. This is simply a way to regulate a state of mind to optimize response. It has nothing to do with ultimate response, but just a process to pause, resonate, and respond. So pause is to simply ground and center. And this, the pause, let me start over because I will send you a little bit about this in a more systematic way, but this begins with any emotional trigger that you automatically respond to, usually without thinking about it, and it's just an automatic response. And the first step when there is any kind of trigger is to pause. And many of you have heard me talk about borrowing, plagiarizing, actually. He didn't publish it, but the words of an old codger, a lovable guy who was a counselor on the alcohol treatment unit back in the day when I had a hospital service. He said, when you're addicted to something, the hardest thing to do is nothing. When there's an emotional trigger, this is the application, when there's an emotional trigger, there's an instantaneous response, and we usually do an action response. So the first step is to pause, and I'll tell you an application of this in just a moment. To pause, because in that 2 or 3 seconds of that pause, that's the delay between urge and action. In that 2 or 3 seconds of the pause between the urge and action, that's where judgment resides. If urge and action are fused, then that's impulsivity or immediate reaction. And that usually is to the content because it's emotionally fueled and already coupled. Think about the people who are closest to you. Think about the first thing that comes to mind about what that person can say or do that will instantly trigger you to an emotional reaction. And the people who are closest to us, we know their triggers because we probably installed a few, and they know ours best, and that can be a way to redirect, especially if you don't want to look at something. I know these things. And redirect to move it to something else or to simply have a discharge. So the pause to then, secondly, resonate with yourself to get grounded and centered. That can be done in 2 or 3 seconds. Then to respond. So here's the last application I did of that. I was working with a C-level person who was having real difficulty with a colleague. And whenever he would walk into that person's room, it was the CEO of a large organization, whenever he would walk into that person's office, even before he put his hand on the door, and he knew something was going down because they were having really contentious problems, and it was affecting the organization in a particular way. So I suggested that he do the Texas three-step: to pause, to connect with himself, and then to get in a position to really respond by listening. And if it's a two-person process, the response needs to be in relation to the other person. If it's a client, for example, to evoke this collaborative framework. No, let's look at this. Or simply to respond to that person first with, I hear your concern, or whatever it is, I understand your overwhelm, and empathic resonance with the other person after you've resonated with yourself. So pause, resonate, respond. And that, if it's another person, that response ultimately is to the other person. Let me give you a simple example of that. And he was able to do this very, very quickly because he had practiced. Each time he was about to open the door to the CEO's office, he decided his cue was to touch his wedding ring. He had touched his wedding ring and took a deep breath, got grounded and centered. This took him 2 seconds, and then he walked in, and he was less and less each time in a reactive position. Let me tell you a vivid example of this. Forget about the Texas three-step, but here is an application of it. I was sitting on a board of directors, and there was a group of maybe 14 or 15 people, and at one point, one of the older members became really impassioned about a position, and as he was describing it, talking about it, he got louder and louder, and at one point, he was almost shouting. As he finally wrapped up, he circled the entire conference table, kind of waving his hands and talking very loudly, came back to his chair as he sat down, slammed both palms on the conference table, and said, "This is what we have to do." And the very wise, balanced chairman of the board said, "That is a point of view. Now, let's hear others." And here's what that did in a genius way. Our most basic desire as human beings is to be effective. I've seen direct infant observations of videos of kids as early as 4 months of age who have demonstrated effectance pleasure, the pleasure of being a cause. That basic desire to be effective finds its way through every scenario and experience we have until our final breath. Every psychological symptom I saw as a psychiatrist and as a psychoanalyst was an attempt to be effective given a situation, circumstance, or internal world that someone had. Now, here's what that means in terms of working with the client. When a client begins with saying, you know, this is just so upsetting to me. The first, and this is again to the three-step, the first is to hear that and resonate with the client. I hear you're upset. Let's look, and it's the collaborative framework here, let's look at how we can understand that. So this is a beginning. This is how someone can feel effective. They have effectively communicated with you. And if you hear it, you know, that is a point of view. They hear it. It doesn't mean you agree with them. Think about the times that you have not felt heard. I know these things also very well. And you've just waited until the other person finishes with their point of view, since they didn't respond to yours. And you wait until they take a breath, and then you come back with your point of view, maybe dialed up just a little bit in case maybe they didn't quite hear everything to agree with you. So this is the beginning of how communication can go awry. This is what can inform us in mentor coaching. The first step is to listen to and resonate with the client, to be grounded and centered ourselves so that we're not in a reactive mode, either emotionally or react to the content to try to bring closure on that and say, well, let's figure out what we need to do to resonate with the client. You know, I hear your confusion or your overwhelm about that. And then let's look at an aspect of that that would give you some traction, and you're also thinking maybe, probably not said out loud, that can be a model for approaching this, a systematic way to look at this that you'll have based on our conversation and the creation of this coaching story that you'll have when you're on your own, and I'm nowhere on the horizon. So these are simply things to think about. I hope that's a a reasonable explanation of the Texas three-step. So what states of mind and energy balance need to be optimum for best decisions? What we regard as actionable data may need reflection and careful planning. An emotional trigger can become that default action due to the neural conditions and connections that have been established and enhanced. In other words, that emotional reaction may be hardwired, and that's what makes it hard. So this is where the pause can be useful to not instantly move into that emotion and reaction, but to be aware and to have that pause where judgment can be used before deciding what's next. And that resonance with yourself, that's the second step. That pause is a resonance with yourself. Then an application of that can be to respond either yourself, if you're with someone else, your client, to respond to that client and engage them in a collaborative exploration together with a focus and a destination. And this may occur several times. And this is something I think that it will be helpful to reflect on the things that are emotional triggers and to recognize those and have an alternate plan. And those of you who have seen this, I want to reference again the very bottom of the homepage of MentorPath, my website, MentorPath. The very bottom is a link to, it's a 30 or 35 minute webinar on master states of mind. And there's a systematic way to look at this very process to recognize emotional triggers and the content of the state of mind that it boots up, because that state of mind is usually a time capsule. The same kind of emotional reactivity, the negative self-talk, the behaviors, to then recognize it sooner and sooner to create a mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology, like touching his ring before putting his hand on the doorknob, taking a breath, and having a focus phrase. That 2 or 3 seconds can create a grounding and centering. When you do it enough, as you'll see there's another illustration of a case in that webinar. When you do it enough, simply the cue will be enough to create that grounding and centering, because you've hardwired. That's the neural conditioning chart that you'll see there to extend this a bit beyond our discussion right now. So let me pause and see how see what you think. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. Any other thoughts, questions, clarifications? Is this seeming useful to you, or are there clarifications to make it more useful?
Hi, this is Julie.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Catherine, and I can chime in afterwards.
Hi, I just wanted to say great stuff, and of course, Dr. Kruger. And so I'm thinking that in applying this, when we're coaching a client, we're human, coaches are human, and there might be something that a client says that kind of just maybe unsettles us a bit, and we could use this Texas three-step to pause and then to resonate with ourselves, to get ourselves centered, and then to respond. In converse, how would we apply this? And maybe you said that, but I'm just not getting it. Apply it, though, to to help the client with the client? I mean, I can see where we would use it, but how would we apply it for to help a client use it as well? To tell them about it, or which way?
Well, and I probably didn't mention it, as you probably figured out by now. I'm just making this stuff up as I go along. So yeah, I would what I do with the client, I will only conceptualize. I'm not teaching, training, doing anything like that, but I want to be sure that the client has it and practices it. That, when you have your experience with the CEO, at what point do you notice a shift in your experience? Well, as soon as I get ready to walk in, man, I got my fighting britches on. So, at that point, then, let's figure out a way that will work for you to pause and to get grounded and centered that will be effective and establish that mindset throughout the conversation. And what we did then was he decided he would use a simple explanation and example at the beginning of that Master States of Mind about a cue of focus of physiology. The cue is to something to remind you to get grounded and centered. The focus is to align your energy field in your brain. And the physiology is a deep breath. And remember, we talked about the Roger Reed example of the free throw. So that can be done in 2 or 3 seconds. So he found his own version. He decided to touch his wedding ring and to have his own focus phrase for those meetings with that person, because that was his major deal. And then to take a deep breath while he was doing it. So he worked out the process and figured it out as we were talking about it. And that whole thing took 3, 4, 5 seconds. I suggested that he practice that a number of times at home to get grounded and centered, just as I would perhaps suggest or figure out how someone may be doing a mindfulness and suggest that they figure out a systematic way to do that a time or 2 or 3 a day when they find it useful. Sure. I'm gonna go back. Well, can you manage the background noise? So to practice mindfulness meditation, to be able to use it, to practice this little process, this little 3-step process, in order to respond and sustain that. And mention too, at times, once you walk in the door, there's nothing magical. You may need to touch your ring at various points. You may need to pause. And instead of react, touch your ring and say, that's a good question. Or, let me think about that. Or, I hear what you're saying. Something that will resonate with that person's experience instead of just having his own program or reactivity. So it's all about contingent conversation. We're establishing, as coaches, we're establishing the model of that. We establish a way that someone does not usually think about that's different than their usual mind and brain programming to speak extemporaneously, to look at problems. We're doing something different with developing a coaching story. What would you like us to focus on? What would you like us to get to? And to develop, those are the two coordinates of the map. We're developing and it's not just a slice of life. We're not asking the client to just tell us a situation and we'll start dealing with that. We're developing a coaching story that includes determining a beginning and end to reflect on that process, so that once we're nowhere on the horizon, they sit down at their desk and they've got 4 or 5 things going on. Well, I'm going to pick one. What do I focus on? Where do I want to get to with this? And look at a time frame to develop it. And that map can determine the two coordinates of any map, where you are, where you want to go, how to measure progress along the way. You've got 15 minutes to do it. You can measure progress along the way, and you're, because you've hopefully selected something that's doable in that time, and you know what's deter and distraction. And this is where we come in as coaches, and then why I request the permission to interrupt. If there's a detour or a usually a move toward the default mode of operating to start talking in paragraphs and free associating, then I will interrupt and ask a specific aspect of that or to look at that and what they want to focus on and collaborate. This is where we have to have, I believe, a working alliance with someone. They have to know beyond the shadow of a doubt that we have 100% interest and dedication to their success. They need to know, especially the way I operate, they need to know that we are not being critical or pejorative or judgmental or running in our agenda or our plays. That's why here's a metric of how I believe I can measure that working on. When I feel like I can get away with saying what I need to say, then I know that working alliance is there, and that person knows totally I have their best interest at heart and that I'm not being judgmental or doing anything with my agenda or being critical of them. They know that we're looking together and that their success is not just preeminent, but a sole focus. Was there another comment? There are a couple of things I want to add here at the end, and I'll go back on lecture mode. But there was another comment, and thank you for deferring. Would you go ahead now, please?
I'm just going to share that just after you shared this framework with us a few weeks ago, I had a client who was dealing with a situation, and it was just extremely helpful to walk her through it. It was the first time I had taken anyone through the framework, and so I shared that. Like, I just learned about this, and I think that it might be something that you might find helpful, and walked her through it, and it was very, very helpful. She used a lot of, she likes to journal, and so she added some of the questions and that you talked us through and walked us through as part of her journaling, and it was been a very helpful exercise for her.
Well, here, I'm going to highlight a couple of things I hear you doing. One is you're establishing that collaborative framework. That is unique, I believe, to professional coaching. Every other professional, there's a consultancy that you go to an expert, you ask a bunch of questions, answer a bunch of questions, and then you find out from the expert what to do. We establish a collaborative framework. The client is the point of reference. And we help them develop their story for that session, and the coaching engagement is its own story. So you've established that framework where the client knows they're the point of reference for their story, and that you customized it to that person's style. You saw, or heard rather, that the person usually worked by writing about it. They're not a visualizer. They're not a kinesthetic person usually. They wrote about it. They're a talker. So you furthered in that person's style, the recognition of that, probably intuitively, maybe consciously, that furthering that style would be useful and a useful framework to consider application of systematic ways to do that. Does that sound fair for what you said?
Yes, you said it in a much more eloquent way than I did, but it was very, very helpful to her. So I really appreciate that, and just the reminders today of some of the ways that we can continue to include that both for ourselves, as someone else pointed out, and for clients as well.
Great. Okay. Nice. Great illustration. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else? I want to reserve a few minutes to to add one more thing and to wrap up, but I'm very interested in what your thoughts and questions are. Anyone else? Well, I'm going to go back on lecture mode to have one other bullet that I left out, and then a kind of an overview from a mind-brain sciences perspective to coaching. The other bullet, does how you began a conversation really make a difference? Well, the answer is obviously yes, or I wouldn't have asked the question. Be mindful of the first words you speak as a coach, or even you'll get faster feedback with your adolescent, if you want to use that as an example. We know from the neuroscience of conversational intelligence that the first words spoken trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener to boot up, or reader, to boot up a specific mindset that then processes the remainder of the conversation. A conversation that begins in a collaborative mode, as we do in coaching, hopefully, activates the brain's neurochemical system involving also oxytocin. Oxytocin is the chemical of bonding and connection. So this initial perception of a collaborative trusting response induces listening without judgment, paying full attention to both coach and client, and frames the remainder of the conversation as a joint endeavor. Now, you have to sustain that, but the client feels safe and understood from these first few words and develops trust. And that's the first aspect from the Texas three-step, is to reflect what the client is experiencing, if that, or what the client said. You know, I hear your concern about that, or, you know, I hear that. That's effectiveness. That means the person feels heard, is effective in being heard. Then they're ready to engage with you. Now, consider, on the other hand, a conversation that begins with what is even perceived to be authoritative or judgmental or critical or just adversarial or judgmental in general, activates the brain circuitry mediated by a different set of neurochemical reactions, including fight and flight, bringing trust into question, protectiveness. The client can then experience questions or distrust or anxiety and may step back just a little bit for self-protection. Keep in mind that this response is innate. It's based on the body's neuroception. It's not a conscious choice, but we can, as coaches, be conscious of what may optimize the possibilities for this. So here's a summary, then, of listening as mentor coaches from this perspective. We become accustomed to listening to and co-creating a coaching story without trying to fix it or run in place. First, put your ego in a blind trust. In other words, don't take it personally. Someone is going to show, some of you have heard this example. I was referred an executive who had alienated everybody in the executive suite. I mean, literally, there were like six people. He had alienated the five other people, and they had banded together. They were about to effect his firing, and finally, the CEO said, "Well, you know, let's give him one more shot. Let's send him to Kruger." So he had found a specific way to. So we started working, and guess what? In the very first session, he began to irritate me, and I knew that he was doing his job description. His job description as a client first and foremost was to show me exactly what it's like to be him. He was not conscious. He was aware, sort of, but he was not consciously aware of the process to say, okay, well, here's the problem. You know, I piss off people. I know how to do this. I know. No, he showed me. So my first challenge was to engage him, to create a working alliance enough that we could examine this together and develop a self-awareness and self-reflection so that he could develop empathy with himself following the empathy that I attempted with him so that he could internalize this process to look a bit more objectively at his own experience. And most importantly, nothing about the whys, leave that to the therapists and the counselors, or the history or the dynamics or whatever. It was the choice architecture of this moment. How could he engage more effectively? So, ego and a blind trust. Listen to the language, whether it's active or passive. That will tell you how someone regards their own authority. If it's passive language, well, you know, I didn't have time to work out, or this just seemed to happen. They're creating a way of seeing themselves as being active, as being passive. So again, each of these are coachable moments to move to an active language to actively determine. Listen to the point of reference, whether it's internal or external, to move to an internal point of reference. That client is the protagonist of his or her story. Listen to the source of authority, whether it's self or others. And if the coach will move it to oneself rather than being acted on by someone else. Listen to the initiation of action, whether it's proactive or reactive. And listen for how centered the speaker is in their own experience. This is what we want to help someone do, to experience themselves fully from within as they're creating their own story. Listen for the state of mind of the speaker, of the client, and whether that state of mind is regulated and fits the task. So this may be the first step for someone in a session, is to help them get grounded and centered. Some of you have heard this story. There've been two times that someone has called during a scheduled time and said, "Well, I just had, you know, some major stuff happen, and I just feel overwhelmed, and I just need to reschedule." And I said, "You know, I hear that. I understand. Would you like for us for just a minute to focus on a way for you to get more grounded and centered?" And fortunately, the person agreed. And with one person, I did a mindfulness meditation for a minute, focusing on breathing. The other, I did a progressive relaxation. And within a minute, each person found a way to really feel grounded and centered and use the session in a productive way. My belief is the most important thing that happened in that entire session was the first minute, because that was a way that the client experienced getting grounded and centered themselves in their own way that they could then take away and use. Also, listen for self-reference in the first or second person. Notice the next time you'll see this most likely in interviews with athletes. They're talking about something, and they're talking about themselves, and they're talking about the experience. And when we talk about an experience, we say I, or we use first person. If suddenly somebody switches to you, something's going on. And my theory would be they're distancing themselves somewhat from their own experience, something they want to disavow or distance. And again, I don't do this regularly, but I don't hear it regularly either, two or three times I've asked for. I said, you know, when you're describing that, you suddenly moved to you as if you're an observer of that. Is there something about that that you may have been uncomfortable about, or is tough to look at? And each time it was, well, yeah, let's look at that together if you're ready. So here are some elements of mentor coaching for successful change, kind of a summary. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits. Regulate a state of mind and manage emotions, first for the client, to do themselves, and then to collaboratively pursue together. New insights occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, grounded and centered. Facilitate insight, exploration, rather than giving advice. People usually can discriminate between inquiries that prompt insight from attempts at persuasion. And I'll tell you who can really discern that is ICF for your first level of certification for those of you who are doing that. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative, reframe to positive, away from negative or problems. Facilitate new behavior and guide the development and actualization of new ways of looking, even new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model, in order to facilitate increasing mastery or a new level of mastery. If someone diverts to an old feeling or a problem, simply redirect the ideas and energy to the new idea. If they continue to do that, then look at the process and get them to help you observe that, because that gets to a familiar place to repeat and usually indicates at the instant of reverting to that old model, that default mode, is a little bit of trepidation or uncertainty in this moment that they stop that and then boot up the old mindset in that order. Remember the power and the focus, that permanent change arises or is created from the consistency of that focus. I know we're going a few minutes over, so hang with me if you would, just for three or four extra minutes. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and brain. And it may be helpful to conceptualize the map with the client in order to master and internalize the process, like the way of being of the cue, the focus, the physiology. That's a kind of microsystem, the Texas three-step, a microsystem to get grounded and centered to reflect and then respond, first within oneself and then secondly to someone else. So, as we close, here are a couple of my predictions, since you asked. Going forward, I think we will develop ways of recognizing and understanding synchronicities, individual and collective energy fields, and a number of phenomena which are part of our experience and universe that in the tomorrows ahead we will evolve concepts and descriptive systems for things that we don't quite understand yet. We'll develop words and a language, a nomenclature for things that we can only sense right now. For example, individual and collective energy fields that stem from Einstein's unified field theory for human energy. So, in doing this together, you've embraced your growth mindset to engage in our discussions. Congratulations on that. That's huge. The magician, Harry Houdini, reminded us, just because something's unexplained doesn't mean it's supernatural. So keep an open mindset. And to paraphrase Garrison Keillor, be well, be happy, go out and do good works. So it's been my pleasure and my privilege to discuss these notions with you, to hear from you, and to hear what will be of most help to you in these seminars. I hope we'll have additional opportunities to collaborate. Thank you for this. It's been a very special experience, and I really value your input and feedback and kind words. I'm very grateful for that. If I can be of help to you, let me know. Thanks very, very much. See you guys. Bye now.